The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. This month's guest is Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, who is making her second appearance with us, on this occasion for her latest novel, Americana. The book takes its title from the name given by Nigerians to their compatriots who have left for the US. And that's what this novel is all about. It has won the National Book Critics Award in America and was shortlisted in the UK for the recent Bailey's Prize. Most of the novel is written in flashback about the heroine's sojourn in the US, so host John Mullen asked her why she decided to sacrifice plot excitement by doing this.
You know, I think there's the uncertainty that still remains of whether or not she'll go back home. But you're right, though, and it was a choice I made. And I think it's because, for me, the novel was much more about... I think it was much more about going home and what home means than it was about the actual leaving and what happens when you leave, I think. And I wrote it in the way that it is in the book. I mean, I wrote it starting off and then going back. And for me, the writing process was very much shaped by my knowledge of the present, of her present. I wanted the reader to go to her past knowing her present. I thought it was important because I think you read it differently. It becomes more, I don't know, I'm very much drawn to a certain kind of nostalgia. And I think that when it's done that way, some kind of nostalgia shapes your reading of the past because you kind of know that, you know where she is now. And also I think there's something about coming to know her better. You start off with this character who, you know, you're not quite sure what to make of her. I think the more you, there's a sense in which she becomes more rounded and fuller, the more you learn of her past. And I think just in a more practical way, I found it more interesting as a writer to write it in that way, to know that she was already in the US and that she's kind of looking back, but also looking forward, and that she's looking back at a particular point where she's thinking about going back home. She's made the decision, more or less. And then she's looking at the yesterday. And what I didn't know was whether or not she would go back home, actually, when I started.
Really?
No, I didn't. I wasn't sure that what, she would.
You thought she might come back from Trenton, New Jersey?
Yes, and pull out the braids and say, I'm not
after
doing this.
6 hours. 6 hours of having it. Yeah?
Yeah, that's,
really?
Yeah, so, 6 hours is not remarkable. I don't know if any, any women with braids say, they're like, 6 hours, that's small.
Because I read it the whole time with a confidence that you lacked, obviously, that she was going to go back. And therefore, I mean, I suppose, for instance, her relationships, the two main ones she has when she's in the States, with Kurt and then with Blaine.
Yes.
So she's having this relationship with Blaine, and I'm just all the time thinking, forget it.
Maybe Blaine, she wasn't supposed to be with Blaine forever.
Yeah.
But she was with him, and I think you know, she learned from him, he learned from her, she... kind of grew. I think it was important.
It's funny you say the question of how long one of the characters is with another, because one of the things that the way you narrate it does is it sort of scrambles time a bit, because Obinze, he's there in chapter two and he's in his Range Rover or whatever it is, and he's in some crowded Lagos street. He's got a guy driving him. He's going back to his house. There's somebody who's employed just to open the gate. You know, so he's done really well. Why are you laughing?
I'm sorry. For the Nigerians, the Indians, the Bangladeshis, the Pakistanis here, they're thinking it's kind of normal. But in his case, yes.
Yes.
But I think having a gay man is fairly middle class. I think that knowing Obinze has done well for himself, and then going back to read about what he's been through, so to speak. I don't know, it seems to me that... more interesting. And I think maybe it's also that I'm struggling to find a reason for what is simply that I find it difficult to tell stories in a way that doesn't find a way to snake itself back and forward. I think I just really find that difficult.
After you told me that you didn't know when you were writing it if she was going to go back, when did you decide that she was?
I'd written quite a bit. And then at some point, I guess I knew she would go back. But then what I didn't know was whether it would have a Meals and Boone ending.
Yes.
I'm not very good at happy endings. I'm quite distrustful of a certain kind of excessive happiness. But I believe in things in small doses. I like slices of happiness and slices of redemption. And it seems to me that the Meals and Boone ending just, you know, it requires faith in a kind of excessive. And so I really forced it to happen, because although it's not as Mills and Boonish, because I've heard from women who are very upset, I think I made it happen. I wanted, very much consciously wanted, to write an old-fashioned love story.
Yeah.
An old-fashioned love story that is unapologetically about that idea of first love is the love that endures and you find each other in the end and all of that. I was getting to the end and she, Femalu, was being very difficult. So at some point I thought to myself, you know, this has to happen, right? So in the way that often I let my characters lead, this time I stepped in.
Right.
And I said to her,
you've got to do it. But I wouldn't say it's classic Mills and Boone.
No, of course not. This is it. I read Mills and Boone novels when I was a teenager. I must have read maybe 2,000 of them.
2,000, I think, is a lot.
All right, but anyway, I found them quite formulaic. And even then, I found it very irritating that the women were often quite limp. Mm. There was just a sense of that they didn't have agency, and that often the man would pull her to him and then she would collapse against him. And, you know, desire was never hers. Desire was something he made her have. And even then, I think, I just knew that this didn't seem right. And so clearly Americana wasn't going to be like that. My female characters actually have agency and own their own desire. But I also wanted to make it kind of messy and realistic, and because I think that's how real life works. I don't think Ifemele is a kind of character who would just sit there pining until he comes and pulls her to him. So I wanted to make it messy, because Obinze, in many ways, Obinze is different. Obinze is not the norm. His friend is the norm. But of course, I don't think I'm very interested in the norm. Obinze is interesting to me because of the way that he fits, but also doesn't fit a certain kind of young Nigerian maleness. And his friend is right in many ways, that kind of behavior of, I'm in love with someone else, I'm leaving my wife. Many Nigerians would say, we really don't do that. Right? You know, you just... You know, you have a responsibility, you have a wife and children, stop this nonsense. If you must have a girlfriend, then have a girlfriend, but don't go and leave your wife, kind of thing. And Obinze is different in the way that there's a sensitivity to him. Actually, I've had many Nigerian women, not just Nigerian women, many women say to me, where is he? Can we have his phone number? and then some other Nigerian women who've said to me, there's no such man like him. So
I can't resist asking about a character who, to me, is in a way my alternative heroine in the novel, because it's the character, in a way, has the toughest time, which is Auntie Uju. Mm. Feels like she has lots of the kind of sufferings that the main characters manage to sort of escape.
That's actually interesting. You know, I think Auntie Uju, in many ways for me, was as important as Obinze and Ifemele. There's certain stories I wanted to tell about a certain kind of woman, a certain kind of immigration, a certain kind of American experience that I couldn't tell with Ifemele, which interests me very much. There's a kind of practical, often quite stoic attitude that some women have about their romantic lives that I find fascinating. You know, Auntie Uju, she's come to the U.S. The U.S. in many ways has reduced her. And she's gone from being this sparkly person with a lot of texture, as she was in Nigeria, and a person who refused to conform in Nigeria, to suddenly this person who overconforms and who's very practical about, well, you know, he's Nigerian, he's a male, he has what it takes to give me a baby, so let's do it. You know, I was interested in that, and also in how Ifemelu just struggles to make sense of it, because Auntie Uju has gone from the sparkling presence in her life, and then in the U.S. she just becomes,
yeah.
I saw it as a mechanism for self-preservation for her, She's had this trauma in Nigeria. She has to make it in America. I think also there's a fear of, I'm alone now. I don't have anything to fall back on. And so I'm going to go to the other extreme. I'm going to be the good, dutiful, grateful immigrant. And that's what she does.
Yeah. I just sort of wonder about blogs. I've known people say, well, you can't use things like blogs and emails in novels because they're not very literary, because they're full of sort of assertion and generalization, and novels are all about sort of ambiguities and uncertainties and complications.
The very idea of this novel and the wanting to write this novel in the way that I did it, I think is in itself a challenge to the notion of the novel as a repository of uncertainties. And I think because I knew I was writing about race, which is a subject that, race in America in particular, but in general, that is huge and contested and makes people uncomfortable, and I wanted to write it in a way that wouldn't have many uncertainties. Writing the blogs, actually, I think that was probably the most enjoyable part of the process for me, because I would write and then stop and laugh quite stupidly, and then write more and laugh. And there are many other blog posts that didn't make it into the novel. Because I had all these notes, I'd done some research, and I would remember something and think, yes, that's going. And so I had a lot of fun. But also, I know that blogs are not necessarily very literary, but I also thought that there's a certain contrast between the ephemeral in the blog is not the ephemeral that we meet in the rest of the novel. It's quite, and even the voice is different.
Yes, because I don't imagine ephemeral laughing as she wrote them.
No. Ephemeral doesn't have much of a sense of humor.
No,
she becomes a different self, which is why she's both excited and terrified by the readership that she's amassing. And also, I think to make it believable that she does so well with this blog, it had to be. I mean, I think if she wrote a kind, gentle blog on race, nobody would really care. And then the story wouldn't make sense because I needed her to earn a living from the blog. So
most of Ifemelu's blogs are about race, but race is something in the novel that she sort of discovers when she goes to America.
Yeah, which I think is why she writes the blog. I think if she had been born in the US, it wouldn't be news to her. Because she looks at race through the eyes of an outsider, she's able to see certain things that may not be that obvious to people who are immersed in that world. But also, I don't think she would be able to say the things that she says. Because I think part of this novel also, one of the things I found I wanted to explore, write about, is the idea of, that America is a country that prides itself on having freedoms. But there's a lot of censorship. There's a lot about what you're supposed to say and how you're supposed to say it. And part of learning America is learning that. That things are said, and often they mean other things, but you don't say those other things, and that sort of thing. And if Ifemelu discovers she's black, as I did when I went to the US, and in some ways it can sound very silly because, if you say that, people say, well, don't you look in the mirror? But it's very different. I think race as a concept, as a social thing, is very different from just looking in the mirror. Because I went to the US, and in Nigeria, I hadn't thought of myself as black because I just didn't need to. And I had read about race. I mean, I was a child who at 10 was reading Roots. But it just seemed very interesting and distant. And then to go to the US and to realize that not only was I now that black girl, as one of the professors in my class said, but that this black meant things. That it wasn't a value-free category. That writing the best essay in class surprised my English professor. Because he looked at me and he looked at the name and he said, that's you. And I said, yes. And he looked surprised because he didn't think a black person had written the best essay. And for me, coming from Nigeria, where I thought, surely everybody knows Nigerians are very brilliant. to come to the US and to suddenly have this black category put on me was actually quite strange. And it was something I then had to learn about. And even African Americans in the US assume that when you have skin this color, then you get it. And often you don't, because if you haven't been raised in a society that has race as a major societal force, you don't actually get many things. You don't get that you're supposed to be ashamed of looking a particular way. You don't get that. You didn't get the memo. So, I agree with Ifemelu about 80% of the time. And many of the things that she writes about are often extreme versions of what I observed and made notes of in my time in the US. So I think that if an African American had written my novel, my sense is that the reception might have been different. I think there's a kind of permission that I have as a foreigner to say certain things that an African-American writer would most likely be punished more severely for, if that makes sense. Mm. in American political and cultural discourse, race is something people tiptoe around. And the literature reflects that. So when you write about race, never mind that novels are supposed to be subtle, race is particularly over-subtle. So half the time, you don't even know if you're not sure. Sometimes you just don't know. You're thinking, is it race? Is it not? And at some point, I started to think, but that's not how people actually experience race. It's an unsubtle experience, often.
Because of what you've just been saying, the visit to the hair salon becomes more and more... I mean, the more you read the novel, the more significant it seems that that's where you are.
But it's interesting, though, because I remember in the US when I'd go get my hair braided and my roommates, who were all white Americans, would say, oh, my God. And I didn't think... I thought, yeah, I mean, actually, the braider was fast. She did it in 5.5 hours, right? And my roommates would go... But I think that the African hair braiding salon in the US is a wonderful cultural institution. It's also a teaching space about many things, about what it means to leave the continent of Africa and about gender as well. And so I would go to get my hair braided, which I used to do quite a bit some years ago. I don't much anymore. And I would take notes because I just found it fascinating watching these women, the interactions between the women and the customers, how they change depending on what kind of customer came in. What that said about immigration and about the need to succeed. And so I just really wanted to try and, if anything, actually celebrate that in a way. I wanted to write about it fondly.
And Ifemelu sometimes seems to have very strong views about, you do your hair like this, it means you've copped out,
I don't know about copping out. No, I think there's a scene in the novel where she's told, if you want to get the job, straighten your hair, which came from my experience. I was going to do an interview for an internship in Philadelphia, and this lovely woman at my university said to me, all right, so we have everything. And then she says in a much lower voice, you want to straighten the hair. In many ways, she was right. She meant well. And this was simply because it's been in the news recently about the U.S. Army and how they have these rules about hair and how the black women in the army are protesting because the idea of what is normal in a woman's hair is often based on this prototype that is in itself created from white women. And so when you have hair that grows up and somebody tells you, oh, surely you can just push it back in a bun. But you're like, it doesn't know how to do that. And you say, well, if I'm going to do that, I have to get it dreadlocked. And then they say to you, dreadlocks are unprofessional. And then you're thinking, well, I think that hair is political. I think that women's hair very often isn't just about hair. And I think because the larger world doesn't really know, it's easy, for example, if you were interviewing somebody, to have this woman walk in with dreadlocks and for you to think, her hair is strange, and then to think maybe it means something, and to think, will she fit into the culture of the workplace, right? Just because it's the world hasn't defined it as normal and mainstream. And I think it has consequences for people because it really limits the choices that many black women have. I think it's part of Ifemelu's journey because when she straightens her hair, she gets the job, and then she has a very bad experience with the relaxer, which also is very loosely based on a personal experience of mine. Because when I got to the US, I just couldn't afford to go to a hair salon. Those things are just ridiculously expensive. And in Nigeria, I could go every week. But then in the US, I couldn't. So I had to do it myself. And it was a disaster.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
I think it's time that I shut up, probably, and gave everybody here a chance, I think.
The characters say "oh" at the end of a sentence. Can you? Which, when I first thought, I thought it was a typo. So, can you explain that? How it fits in a conversation?
I love that question. Is there any Nigerian who wants to help? So, you can use it for emphasis. It can sometimes, in certain contexts, show that you're being lighthearted. So, I'll eat your food, oh. It was very important for me to try and capture that in the novel because I wanted the reader to know that there's a particular Nigerian-ness in the dialogue. But, so I'm so pleased that you noticed. And
I have got a question. Oh. How much do you think race is the way you look, and how much do you think race is a social construct and what people expect of certain people with certain skin colors?
I think intellectually I understand the idea that race is a social concept, but also I think that race is not biology, in my opinion, but race is sociology. But I think race matters. Race matters because we live in a world that historically has made race matter. And the reason that I sometimes have a problem when people say, oh, but race is just a social construct, is that it can seem to me a bit dismissive, and it's a way to close down real conversations that I think need to be had. That in the US, for example, people would say, race is just a construct and I don't see color. Or I'm colorblind. It doesn't even make sense. Because people are so uncomfortable about it, I think it's all about the way you look. I think the world judges you based on how you look. If you're asking somebody who looks like they're from Pakistan and is in a certain part of the UK, whether their experience is the same as the experience of a person who looks like they're from the middle of Norway, I don't think that the experiences would be the same. Race is absurd because it's often quite stupid. You know, in the way that people think, if you have dark skin, then you're not likely to be very intelligent. Or the way that it's still remarkable that somebody who's brown is in a certain position of power, that kind of thing, right? You know, for me, I think it's important to talk about these things. I think the more we talk about the problems of race, the more likely we are to fix them, I think. And of course, my hope is that, you know, we live in, at some point, we create this world where everybody's equally valued.
What year is it set in? Because I'm interested in the hair stories that you've mentioned.
I imagine that it's set, you know, 1999, 2000, 2001, 2002, and then goes on. But I think today, there's a scene in the novel where Femalu takes her boyfriend, Kurt, to a bookshop, and she brings out these mainstream women's magazines, and she says, now, let's count the number of black people in here. I think if she did that same thing today, the number would be higher.
I really love the politics in your book. I love the blog and the issues around race. But I wondered if you could tell us a bit more about class and inequalities, and also maybe outside of the novel, where you see the forces for change.
Ah, the forces for change. I don't know, education, I guess, good governance, those things. I'm interested in class very much. I think often in Nigeria, when we talk about divisions, we talk about religion and we talk about ethnicity. But I think class is much more important, much more of a dividing force. Than ethnicity, for example. Maybe not as much as religion, but certainly more than ethnicity. Because you find in Nigeria that people of the same class of different ethnic groups, they get along, they intermarry, they class connects in very interesting ways, and groups protect their interests. But it can seem very stark in Nigeria. It can seem very overt in a way. And because I happen to benefit from that, because I happen to have class privilege, there are times when something happens, and many of these privileges, by the way, I enjoy. Guiltily, but I do. And there are times when something happens, and I just find myself thinking, I just got lucky. I mean, it's kind of a privilege you haven't earned in many ways. I was fortunate to be born into a family where I got an education.
Part of the novel is around Obama's victory and the political system.
Yeah.
So do you see that a way?
Yeah. I think... I mean, I have friends in America who are no longer scared of getting sick. And, you know, I do think that something shifted. I still do. And I think there was just a sense of possibility. It worries me now that people are upset that Obama isn't Jesus Christ. But then, you know, he never said he was. So it's just, I find it very interesting. But in general, I think, I do believe very much in getting the right people into positions of power, that change can happen. I really believe that.
I wanted to ask you about the distinction that you draw between black Africans who come to countries for education, because there's a new idea that's been going around about the Afropolitan.
So the African-American would be the person whose ancestors were slaves, were forcefully brought to the U.S. in horrible circumstances. And the American-African would be the person of African descent whose people came willingly. You know, if you had parents who left in the 1960s or 70s and went to the US and had kids who sound American, there's a certain divide. I think many Africans who go to the US often don't really understand the history, and they get to the US and very easily they absorb all the negative stereotypes, and there's so many negative stereotypes about African Americans. And it's very easy to absorb them. and even easier when you want to identify with success. And in America, success often isn't black. So it means that you're then likely to be in circles where you find yourself saying things like, oh, black Americans are very lazy, or black Americans, why do they all live in the ghetto? That means they don't like nice houses. And I sometimes think that I would be saying those things if I hadn't spent a lot of time reading African-American history. But just to go to the bit about the Afropolitan, I've been asked that a number of times, and people have said to me that I'm Afropolitan and they want me to talk about it. And it's important for me to say that I am not an Afropolitan. I'm not quite sure what it means that the idea of an educated, cosmopolitan West African is so remarkable and so unusual that we have to create a new name for it. And I find that very troubling. You know, if you go back, West Africans have been cosmopolitan for 400 years. They've been going to Europe for centuries. It's not... And also, I think it worries me because it can suggest that somehow it's important for us to prove how Western we can be, and that the value we give ourselves depends on how much we know about Paris and Rome. And I'm just thinking, I know many Nigerians who are very cosmopolitan, and they don't think that Paris is the seat of civilization, and why should they?
I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how different groups of people received the book, because it is so unapologetically about race and gender.
A friend of mine told me a story about another friend who's Tanzanian, I think, and whose boss is a white English woman, and who she read the novel on holiday, and she came back and she called him into her office, and he sat down, she said, shut the door, and she said, I want to apologize for all the things I said. And she said, I didn't even know they were offensive. I just want to apologize to you. And in some ways, for me, it was very funny. But also, I found it quite moving because, you know, I really do believe in the possibility of human connection. And I think that a lot of things that people do don't come from malice. It comes from not knowing any better. In Nigeria, many Nigerians don't get the race thing and are not really interested, to be honest. It's doing very well. It's widely read there. But many Nigerians want to talk about the marriage. I can't tell you how many Nigerian women have come up to me to warn me about letting a marriage break up and how much they dislike Ifemelu because she's a marriage destroyer and she's a husband snatcher and all of that. So, you know, I'm often having to calm people down and tell them it's just... In Europe, it's mostly that Europeans are all very keen to ask me about the terrible racism of America. So in Germany, they're like, oh, Americans are terrible. And, you know, the same thing in, you know, wherever, Denmark, wherever. And I find it very interesting because whenever I do these events, there's always a big turnout of black people. And the organizers are always surprised at how many black people actually live in those towns.
When you begin to write, do you come up with the characters first, or do you think about what you want to say?
You know, I think character comes first, I think. But it's strange, because at the same time, I kind of know what I want to talk about. But character certainly comes first. If I don't find my character interesting, then I just won't write. Character certainly comes first. And sometimes they come alive. They become there. And I enjoy that. For me, one of the joys of writing is that it's kind of like going on a journey with somebody you don't know very well and getting to know them as you go along. But also having that wonderful quality of playing God because you kind of meet them. So it's a very strange thing for which I might need therapy. But character certainly. And even for me as a reader, I'm very interested. I like story. But for story to matter to me, the character in that story has to matter.
Did you feel like kind of a burden to write about kind of your experiences in America? And also, how long did it take to kind of do the whole book?
About 6 years. But I had some dry periods when I had very bad depression and couldn't write a sentence. I didn't feel burdened. And this novel, I mean, I don't really have a very interesting life. I mean, I think it's important to say that because there are people who have chosen to just be convinced that Ifemelu is me. And I'm very flattered by that because I find her very interesting. But she's really not me because my life is not as interesting as hers. And so what I've done is that learning about race in America meant that, you know, I read everything and I took notes and I'd read the newspapers and be like, oh, that's it. And at some point, I thought I have to use all this in a novel. That's really what it was. And then, of course, I had friends. I talked to people. I used many people's experiences. So it was less about being burdened. My time in the U.S. was considerably easier than Ifemelu's. Right? But then you need friction in the novel. So you can't just write about just bland. If I wrote a book about my life, nobody would care, really.
My main question was around DK. So I found his story one of the saddest in the book. And I found that your nods towards the racism he experienced was actually quite subtle. And it didn't really explore his feelings around it until eventually he, you know, goes on to attempt to commit suicide.
DK is also loosely based on a real person, but very loosely. I wanted to write about, really largely write about the African immigrant who raises a child in the West from a country that really doesn't do race, and then comes to this new country with that kind of immigrant zeal. All they care about is that the child succeed in school. And they don't realize that there are all of these other small things and not so small things that deeply affect the children. And they're completely oblivious. You don't follow the kid to school, so you don't really know what happens. The kid doesn't talk about it when he comes home, except for maybe the rare time when somebody in his class calls him nigger, and then you go to the principal, and then he's made to shake hands with the guy who called him nigger, and then all is well. But you're not thinking, well, I mean, is he okay, really? Because you don't talk about it, and all you tell him is, you know, go get the A's in class. And I wanted to write about that, because I've seen it quite a bit in African immigrant households, and that there's that it causes a kind of, that, you know, parents, they're well-meaning, but they're just, they don't get it.
Thank you so much for your questions, and I'm sure you'd want me to thank Chimamanda very much.
Thank you.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.